need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, all that time spent at the adult bookstore next to Four Seasons Total Landscaping finally paid off. It's Andy Greenwald!
I'm just popping a cold one over here. Hold on.
Yeah? Is it already Miller time? Mm. Greenwald, packed show today, so let's get into it. We have Mandalorian, we have Queen's Gambit, maybe a little bit of Undoing, and then the rest of the show is dedicated to Claire McNear, who joined us to talk about her new book, Answers in the Form of a Question, her history of Jeopardy, and obviously with the tragic passing of Alex Trebek over the weekend. Really, really sad timing, but who better to talk to about that institution that is Jeopardy than Claire? So really excited to talk to her. We'll get into the show in just a second.
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Oh, Greenwald. Fucking Philly came through, baby.
What? First of all, let me just, let's run through some things that deserve our attention and our acclaim.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, congratulations to Twitter for having its first good day in a decade on Saturday. Bravo. Credit where it's due.
What was the last good day?
There was a day in like 2009 when there was a really big thunderstorm out of the blue in New York, and everybody was pretty funny about that.
Okay.
I remember everybody had bars about that, you know, like everyone got stuck somewhere and took to the Twitters.
Sure.
That was a good day. I enjoyed that.
And then ever since then, downhill?
I feel like that quasi-revolution in Iran was all right. Uh-huh. That was a pretty good one. I want to congratulate—
Linsanity was good. Linsanity was good.
Oh, Linsanity was fun too.
Yeah.
So good job. Let's start recentering and lowering the rhetoric now by giving credit to @Jack when he deserves it. Two, congratulations to the USA, the United States of Antifa, for restoring its dignity on the world stage.
That's right.
Like, I don't even know where to go. And I feel like this is going to come up in our coverage of The Mandalorian, for example, because my compass needle is spinning, baby. Like, I don't know. So I watched the episode of The Mandalorian on Saturday after, not long after watching our president-elect and vice-president-elect
After the mainstream media declared it for Joe?
Yes.
You just fired up Disney Plus?
later in the evening. And yeah. So I don't know whether it was the champagne talking or the sweet, sweet smell of insipid socialism. But I thought it was the best episode the show's ever made. I might be wrong.
You're really wrong.
I thought it was great. I was delighted by it. So
you're also, you have like, you've been like Paw Patrol pilled, where you're just like, all these cute animals are just running around trading eggs.
I thought it was great. I think take everything I say for the next 6 months with a grain of sugar, because, you know, that's where we're at.
This is the time I really have to wheel out big CR's agenda, because I feel like I've really got a soft underbelly here with you. Like, I could get anything across the finish line with you right now. I could be like, Andy, we need to do a 27-part 000 rewatch. And you'd be like, thumbs up.
I mean, why are you starting so small? This is a typical mainstream, centrist, accommodationist, democratic tactic by you. You could radically insist that I watch all three seasons of Ozark. You know what I mean?
That's true.
Like, you could have me reassess True Detective season one. This is your time.
Binge mode Ted Lasso.
But this is so typical. Your suggestion was the Rahm Emanuel of cabinet picks.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody's asking for that. And you've already started where you began. Let's give a little credit to not just our home city, the city of Philadelphia, which really got the kind of national affection it hasn't really gotten since the 1770s. What
doing
a showing
what
on the world
doing
stage.
Doing what we do best by just pissing off Cowboys fans.
couldn't be better. Was truly wonderful and delicious. And I think we also have to say, people have asked us, I noticed, okay, maybe at least one person. I'm not going to do the people are talking thing. But I did notice someone was like, please cover, as you mentioned in your intro, the Four Seasons total landscaping thing. And I can't, perfect joke, no notes. The single funniest thing that has happened in the last 4 years. And it's in like Tacony, right? Like it's in Mayfair. It is nowhere near Center City, Philadelphia. The only way I think people can really understand where this business is located is to close your eyes, put on your best noise-canceling headphones, and listen to Christine Nangle talk. Like, go to Twitter and do yourself that favor, and you will feel what it feels like
to be outside.
To be
that.
Totally landscaped by the Four Seasons company. Veep could never. Veep could never.
Dave,
so good.
I mean, the guy who booked that must have just been like, I fucking nailed it, man.
Yeah.
I got it. Four Seasons didn't have any prior bookings on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon. I just nailed it. I can't believe I'm going to get promoted. And
it's incredible.
It's such a tough beat. Let's start with, well, actually, I mean, do you want to talk a little bit more about how we're feeling or how the weekend went? I think obviously like a very, like we were very tense on Thursday when we or Wednesday when we last did our podcast. So it seems like we're much more upbeat now. How long did it take before you were able to like go back and watch a TV show?
Well, I just said just it was a mere hours.
Yeah.
Before I fired up Mando. I went straight to the Razor Crest, from the Razor's Edge to the Razor Crest.
And I could see you sitting there just being like, and this is it. This is great entertainment. Like, I bet you were really satisfied by it.
Thrilled. Yeah. I was thrilled. And I you know, this is something, we're joking and we're having a good time. That's what we like. That's the subtitle for this podcast, joking, having a good time. But honestly curious how it may affect our ability to watch things and what we're looking for over the next few weeks and months as hopefully the country restores some degree of normalcy. Like, sorry, David Sirota. I'm not pretending that everything's fixed, but I'm just saying I personally have noticed, and I think many in the reality-based community have noticed already just in a few short days,
like
the floor is up.
The cast members of The Bachelorette, the reality-based community.
Yeah, the magical elves, wherever they may be. The floor has been raised. Uh-huh. So I think I texted this to you. Like, I'm not sure I feel great today, but I feel good. I don't know when the last time that is.
That's all we can ask for, really.
So I do wonder if that is going to affect my appreciation of things. Like, there have been moments over the last few days. And look, this is part of the thing that I was trying to talk around the other day, and I still feel like it's true. We just don't want a national crisis and emergency all the time. Like, this stuff is not supposed to, if you're fortunate enough to be in a stable situation, this shouldn't pollute and poison and affect every single aspect of your lives. Like, Twitter helps with that. Twitter helps cause that. Podcasts may help cause it too. But like, taking pleasure out of stuff, let's get that back. Let's bring that back a little bit. So maybe that's why I'm more receptive to The Mandalorian. Maybe that's why I'm more receptive to a long walk with my family as I was yesterday.
Waddle over to a glass tube of frog eggs and just be like, I'll have one of those.
Look at this reversal of fortune. Look at this. Look at this. Were you concerned about now that the country is lurching to the far left, that Mandalorian's mixed messages about family planning might be received differently? Like, is that what you're concerned about? Like, look, the way I look at it is that since Yoda eats the baby frog eggs and then uses the Force to help people, in a way, it's like Regeneron.
Let me tell you something.
Do you get what I mean?
Well, I get it. But one of my major complaints this season is what's going on with Baby Y. And why is he so slow to spread the Force spices around a little bit? He's keeping it all to himself.
For timestamp purposes, are we now talking about The Mandalorian? Or are we still going to make cabinet jokes?
Let's start now. Because my thing is like a very delightful episode of television. High usage rate for Baby Yoda. I love the gifs. I've already used the last shot of him looking over at the frog's tube and then turning back around and quietly popping the egg in its mouth. I've used that like two or three times when texting with my wife from the other room about what to have for dinner. But I have to say, I feel like Baby Yoda is dead weight.
Whoa.
Baby Yoda is not is not doing his fair share of work here. He's basically like, feed me Seymour all day long. And they've been in multiple situations where he could just throw his setup, you know what I mean? Just get his hands up and just a little bit of force, whether it's, I don't know, like confusing the X-Wing fighters that were chasing them last night. Maybe he could like seal the hole with the force. Like he could do some stuff. It's not all going to be knocking him out because he had to like throw a mudhorn somewhere.
Okay. First of all, this is also going in the file as to why Uncle Chris can't babysit. I want the child to pull its own weight. Okay, noted. Noted. Two, I think I'm just going to surgically pick apart your argument like noted legal expert David Bossy.
No, this is going back to like Lonesome Dove, where like Clara's husband was like, we got to have some kids so I can have some more laborers on this windy horse farm.
True. However, I think the main difference is that unlike in the 19th century Texas setting of Lonesome Dove, a lone traveler or a traveler with just a small green child seems almost absurdly able to repair anything that happens to his conveyance.
Yes.
Like built in, and I respect this, but you know, part of the reason I like Mandalorian in general is because it takes all of the things that defined the original trilogy and just leans into them. And one of the things is, it is NBD to go hurtling through a vast and impossible universe in a tin can. It's just never an issue.
Yeah.
They never are like, I got to get fuel here by the Milky Way. They're never like, well, if we crash land on this ice planet, there will be no way to solder the hull.
Like a toolbox. Yeah.
He's got a toolbox and a rifle and it's fine. So I think that we've established that. So Baby Yoda isn't going to be, he's not helping out with the chores around the house, you know, which is, you know, maybe that's kind of antiquated anyway, Chris, because we want to teach children the value of work on their own, right? Not to do our work for us. That's what the latest literature/episode of Bluey taught me. But I also would say for narrative purposes, and again, it's a little high-minded to use the phrase narrative purposes in regards to The Mandalorian, but once you have a kid that has magic that can fix everything, what little drama exists in this very mellow, enjoyable show will melt away.
Yeah, but I'm just asking, like, was there sort of, did they make an agreement with Baby Yoda about how sparing he was going to be with using the most powerful tool in the universe?
By they, do you mean Lucasfilm? Are you under the...
No, I mean, did Mando say to him, look, I know that just wipes you out, man. So just like, I'll tell you when I'm going to call on you for this. Because
I think if I were you, Chris, I would feel that Baby Yoda is using his abilities judiciously because in the last five episodes, going back to the previous season, he really only used it to heal Carl Weathers.
That's right.
And is there a higher calling in this universe as far as your own interest in it goes? Like, that's what he did. So
it's true.
He picks his spots well.
So this episode was directed by Peyton Reed, who handled the two Ant-Man movies for Marvel. So it's
and Bring It On, and a lot of Superchunk videos in the 90s.
That's right. So I think had a really pleasant sense of humor to it, both visual and also plenty of those kind of Han Solo-esque one-liners that I really enjoyed. I do find myself, these first two episodes of The Mandalorian, getting about 11 minutes into it when the sort of main quest has sort of begun, and just being like, wait, what? Okay. Like, I think that Ben wrote about this too on The Ringer, which is these two episodes feel like Mission of the Week-y episodes rather than part of a larger sort of story.
I mean, that seems to be the direction the show is going in, like we were saying the other week about the kind of X-Files-ishness of it. There's going to be a lot of just standalone episodes, and then there's going to be some mythology episodes. And this season is pretty much following the pattern of last season. I think last season started with two more mythology-centered episodes than went into this kind of episode of the week stuff. But I'm not, I'm genuine when I say I think this may have been the strongest episode, probably because it felt, it had the kind of confidence of tone that I think was a little bit lacking in the first season as it found itself. It was whimsical and fun, but with a spirit of adventure. And I think a lot of that came from Peyton Reed's direction, which I thought was exceptional because the action set pieces were really clearly directed. You know, they were, you could tell what was going on. You could tell the threat. You could feel it. It didn't, there was peril. And not just the ice spiders, which, you know, brought back fond memories of that time in the first Halo game 20 years ago.
When oh, yeah. Forgot about
all
that.
All those little aliens come running at you, which is a seminal moment, I think, in our cultural education. But also the opening thing where the little guys set up the trap and messed up the speeder. And then there's the whole thing with the jetpack.
The jetpack was dope. Yeah, I love that.
I thought it was really fun.
Reminded me of Eastbound and Down.
Now that's a crossover I could get behind.
Yeah.
But there's... Maybe this is the key difference, and maybe this does speak to the Daddington nature of most of my viewing these days, but tough guy fighter in a land full of interesting Muppets is fine for me. Like, I feel like that's a... Not, also, let me add, I liked the X-Wings. Like, I liked a little bit of the flavor of the New Republic or whatever. That was cold, though. And again, I feel like those dudes are as confident in literally everyone's mechanical abilities as we ought to be.
Yeah, because
they're like, we're going to leave you here. But
you're good. Yeah.
Is he good? Like, I have a pretty okay car that I lease in Los Angeles, but I don't feel nearly as confident about either its hull integrity or my ability to repair it as
this guy
feels about.
Oh, you don't think you can get in there and take the restrictor plate off?
Like, he's literally flying across the universe, and it's all chill.
Yeah.
That's pretty wild. Can I ask you one more thing? You're much more extremely online than I am. I think everybody knows it. Everybody on the Reddit message boards knows it.
Is that true?
No. But when I go on the subreddit, I like to promote that theory.
Yeah, okay.
And say that you're reading. Where are we in the discourse in the conspiracy theory that Pedro Pascal is literally not there and has never once been in the armor?
This is the thing that kind of got brought up a little bit last season because there were a series of interviews, I think, with the stunt guy, right? Or I'm not trying to disparage anybody by saying like, oh, the stunt guy or not, but like there is a body double or stunt guy guy who is usually in the suit, right? And so Pedro Pascal obviously is the voice of the Mandalorian, but I do not know how much actual Mandalorianing he is doing.
I want to know that because on some level you're like, well, the actor embodies the performance and the character, and there's certain choices. Of course, there are choices being made in terms of the physical performance.
Right.
But it is hard to imagine a more restrictive costume for any actor. And now we've established that we will see his face max once or twice a season.
And he just does the head cock. That's like the most expressive he gets, really.
So people are asking, you know what I mean? When they say, I'm not saying I have the evidence. You know what I mean? I'm just going to file a number of baseless lawsuits in a bunch of states saying, well, I've heard Pedro Pascal is not wearing the armor for most of the episodes.
So my favorite current thing is, you know, so the two X-Wing fighters, one of them was Dave Filoni, another was a guy, I forgot his name from, who's in that show, Kim's Convenience.
Yes.
It seems like every episode, it'll be like, oh yeah, the one-eyed guy was Leguizamo, you know? And
yes.
I just want that to keep going. I love that energy. I just want, I can't wait for like, there to be like an Imperial cast-off, like, person with like massive facial disfiguration who's like working with Esposito's character, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, that was Patricia Clarkson.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought this up because this was the other thing because I'm feeling good and positive, but also I really enjoyed this episode. The other thing that we didn't mention as kind of special sauce about the show is that it does manage to feel extremely and surprisingly personal for a piece of billion-dollar franchise IP. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons that is because Favreau's just Rolodexing it. or dreamcasting it. Like he is bringing in people that he likes, whether he knows them personally or whether that he just likes their performances. Mm-hmm. And speaking as someone with my one so far showrunner experience, like casting people you like is the most fun thing you can do.
Sure.
And I love that about the show. No one was like, get me Amy Sedaris in space. They should have been. Every week brings a very charming new surprise.
Yeah.
That does not feel like it was in any way Disney groupthink. And that helps keep the show grounded in a way that I really appreciate.
I'm obviously really enjoying the show. I think I share Ben's sort of desire for some stakes and to get it going. Let's get the ball rolling.
All the other shows have stakes. I think the thing is for me, what's the ceiling here? Like the stakes are what? That the Force is real? That there's a bad guy with a black lightsaber? Like we're not going to learn anything about ourselves and humanity here, you know? So give me more of the green puppet eating the sticky space bug out of the egg. I enjoyed it. That kid will eat anything.
That kid does not discriminate.
As a parent, I really respect that.
But I just feel like it was just unremarked upon that he ate like 11% of the remaining generation of frog people.
Well, look, there was a little trickery there because by the time he was done, in the beginning, when he was just snack, he was just bobbing for apples, okay? Yeah. It was classic Halloween party behavior. And then later, when Lady Frog takes a jacuzzi bath.
I was like, are we doing water birth? Like, what is happening? Yeah.
That was really interesting. I got to say, it is also very Eastbound and Down to have a character who will risk life or limb for a jacuzzi.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like anything to tub it up a little bit. There seemed to be a lot more eggs all of a sudden once they were moving from hot tub back to glass bottle. So I don't think he ate that many of them in retrospect.
Do you think we get to meet Mr. Toad next week, Mr. Frog?
Let me respond with a question that is extremely Mandalorian. Do you care? Like,
yes. Yeah, definitely.
Like,
so here are the power ranking of things I cared about on Saturday. What's Mr. Frog's story? What's he doing?
What's that dude's about?
Yeah. Like,
what's that dude's life
tell
about?
Me a little bit more about why he's on another planet.
Yeah, like maybe Mrs. Frog should be reading the tea leaves.
He seems a lot like Alma's husband on Queen's Gambit.
Well, yes, or like Nicole Kidman's husband on The Undoing, the other show, where he's just like, peace out, enjoy motherhood. You know what I mean? Like, I'm done here.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, I'm going to hire a high-priced attorney / bounty hunter to reunite us.
Let's talk a little bit about Queen's Gambit. So we checked in on this show. We've talked about it a lot, I think, on the sides and on the margins of a few episodes, but we did a deep dive on the first few episodes, and I finally finished it this weekend. You'd finish it, I believe, on election night.
On election night.
Out of your fucking tree. Well, what the hell, man? I mean, one of the best things that we're going to see all year, I'm fairly certain. And I think takes a turn towards a more mildly conventional resolution than the show itself had been throughout. And I don't say that as a bad thing, because I think I loved this show for two reasons. I loved this show for the way in which it challenged conventions and the way it satisfied certain pleasure centers at the same time. So it turning into a sports movie complete with those guys waiting on the other end of the phone and staying up all night to help Beth plot out how best to beat Borgoff. Mm-hmm. While that felt like Hoosiers, I fucking love Hoosiers. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a reason why people return to those stories and watch Miracle and watch Hoosiers and watch, you know, Rudy and these movies like that. At the same time, I did think that even when they were doing things that felt pretty by the book. And I think that Jolene's return towards the end of the series, like, is more of a vehicle for Beth to reckon with her childhood than anything else. I still found it immensely satisfying and still incredibly well written, gorgeously directed. There was a part of me that I think I really missed Marielle Heller, weirdly, throughout the second half of the season. I really loved the Benny character and the role he plays in it, but there was something electric about Anya Taylor-Joy and Mariel Heller in the show that I did miss for the second half of the season. But the fact that I could have consumed this show in 2 days, I just chose to stretch it out, is the testament to the fact that, you know, we're talking about like real nitpicks on like perfection.
Yeah, if you haven't, I mean, if you're listening to our show and you haven't watched Queen's Gambit yet for whatever reason, please watch it. It's a masterpiece. I adored it.
It's still the number one show on Netflix, so I think most people listening to the show have probably watched it.
I'm so happy about that. I mean, it ticks all the boxes, just objectively, I think, for a major work of this era, in that it is totally compelling and binge-worthy, yet deserves savoring. It contains an absolute star-making performance in Anya Taylor-Joy, and I know that many people have been checking for her for a while and know that she's the real deal. I had never seen her before. Can't say I made it to a drive-in to see New Mutants this summer. Sorry. And as everyone listening knows, I will not watch The Witch. So this was dazzling. Production design, direction, just stunning. But I really do want to say that while this is a show for everyone, you know, and it's been fun to have something like that to recommend to everyone in my life, from total snobs to my parents, or to my dad, who is himself a total snob, I think the show is quietly radical too, in that the way that Beth is presented as a female hero, as a complicated, troubled, difficult woman, and yet ultimately forges these really profound, respectful relationships with people in her life, felt unlike anything I'd ever seen before. Not that I haven't seen it before in life, but particularly her relationship to her mentors. And we flagged it in the first episode. That moment in the basement when she encounters Bill Camp is a sliding doors moment between what the show is and the worst version of what a show like that could be, right?
Yeah.
But that moment actually was instructive because it happens again and again. We should separate out the relationship with Alma, with Mariel Heller's character, because I think that's worthy of discussion also. But the relationships that she forges with Harry, with Benny, with all these dudes basically in her life is really something.
Who's the guy from Kentucky, Towns? Is that his name?
Oh, and Towns, exactly. Yeah. That's the other guy. First of all, remarkable because all of them are British, doing pretty decent American accents. So respect to that. And by the way, where were these British people when they were casting The Undoing, where literally everyone in New York City sounds like they're just there on like some sort of visa that Trump tried to get rid of? But I don't remember seeing a show, I would love to have other examples pointed out to me, where a brilliant woman is time and time again recognized, seen, and respected by the men in her way, or in her path, or along her journey. Do you know what I mean? It's a subtle thing, but it was so thoughtfully executed that it really struck me. And the moment you're talking about, it gave us all that like thrilling sports movie conclusion when all the dudes were there cheering for her and supporting her. But it felt really meaningful. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was a very specific thing that, again, happens a lot in real life where men can be respectful of women who are successful or ambitious or brilliant. But those moments when Harry is like, clearly in love with her, and she's everything he's ever wanted, and he's like,
he got his teeth fixed for her.
He did, and she's and he's like, you don't need me anymore. And then
he went
still
to jail
back.
Just to get his teeth fixed.
I was looking for that. I was looking for the Jadakiss reference too. I think we could make jokes like that in America again. The Benny thing, you know, it's such a strange, complicated relationship.
Yeah,
but it's based on respect, and that elevated the whole series for me. I just thought it was so thoughtful and appropriate for a project that was, to your point, Chris, really invested in the idea of a hero's narrative, right? Like, this is an enjoyable show. It was never at odds with itself about it, how it wanted to trick us or surprise us in those ways. Like, it gave us the thing that you want, but it did so in such thoughtful, empathetic, and generous ways that I'm still floored by it.
I also thought it was a pretty nuanced and complicated portrait of addiction. You know, and I think the relationship between addiction and creative inspiration is a really complicated one. It's one I'm pretty fascinated by. But I think that you and I have both grown up at various points enamored with and skeptical of some of our favorite artists going through really, really difficult times with substances, and the connection between like some of our favorite work by those artists mm-hmm. being directly related to those, or the, you know, the connection that's made between those things. I thought that that was maybe the most interesting part of the show, is the way in which they talked about Beth's chess genius, which I think is easily a stand-in for creative genius. And if you read Dave Hill's amazing piece about Walter Tevis on the site, he talks about Walter Tevis's pretty crippling alcohol problem.
The novelist who wrote Queen's Gambit.
Yeah, and he basically came out of the gates in his early 30s, I think. He had already written The Hustler and The Man Who Fell to Earth, and everybody was just like, "Walt, what's next?" And he moved to Mexico and just drank gin, you know? And
it's a weird choice in Mexico.
And essentially, like, devoted much of his adult life to playing pool and chess and drinking, and not finishing a novel, which I now in retrospect
I can relate to a lot of that. Yeah. That sounds pretty good.
But the portrait of Beth, and whether or not it's the tranks and being able to see things on the ceiling when she takes mm-hmm. these tranquilizers, I thought that especially the episode, I think it's the second to last one, where she's left Benny. And just the slippery slope of it all, the way in which if Beth has a pastis in Paris, she basically wakes up the next day and has no idea how she got there. When she gets home to Lexington, it's going out for a Gibson one night.
Right.
And then it's a bender. And the way in which it starts with this kind of almost like magic elixir that she takes to tap into a creative side of her brain, and then just becomes a full-blown dysfunctional addiction in her life that she is self-aware about. I think she knows that.
Well, it's a really interesting, I mean, when you see it in art, it's interesting. When it's experienced in your life, it's very, very, I'm not saying me personally, but when one experiences something like this in one's life, it can be extremely challenging and traumatic, which is the relationship between who you are, who a person is, and their gift or their talent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, integrating those two things is an enormous challenge for people who are very talented. You can read sports biographies and find this. You can read, you know, autobiographies or memoirs of ballerinas or composers. I mean, this is as you said, this is a common refrain in human existence. And the idea in Beth's own relationship to her genius, that she's so, on some level, she's afraid of nothing when she's sitting at the chessboard, but the deep fear she has of actually interrogating what her ability is and what her relationship to it is. What does it say about her? What does it say about how it comes to her? You know, she keeps rejecting advice and she keeps rejecting expertise because she's just a player by feel, right?
Yeah, like she's intuitive. Yeah,
she's intuitive, which is romantic, especially from the outside, and beautiful, but also potentially really destructive. And I also really liked the way that the show kind of nimbly articulated that and did so in a way that, I know we said this the other week, so glad it wasn't a movie. Also, being totally honest, like, I could have had 7 more episodes. It's good that there weren't 7 more episodes because it did say what it wanted to say and what Scott Frank wanted to say about it. But there very much could have been more. But sure. Ending with her being like, let's play, going back to this idea of playfulness as opposed to obligation or work or self-definition was lovely.
Yeah,
and really, really, really fitting, and just so satisfying. I mean, that's the other thing. Every episode felt that way, but as an entire project, right? Like, it felt really good when it was over, and that alone is worth pointing out.
I think that, you know, I've seen a couple of things here and there about like, oh, they should do more of these, or they should do another season of it, and I think that's a natural reaction. I was thinking about like a lot of the stuff that happens in Paris and in Russia, and at those moments, especially, although of course throughout the entire series, but especially in those episodes, I was so acutely aware of the level of thoughtfulness that went into like the production design and mm-hmm. the costume design, and how she's wearing these almost chessboard like patterns. And then the wall has this sort of, you know, whether it's sconces or kind of like just these sort of flourishes on the walls themselves that's those same geometric patterns. And like everything is a chessboard, and the way that she is being moved through this world is so precise. Yeah. And I've seen some great stuff about like how the different characters represent different figures on a chessboard, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, whether Benny is like the bishop because he's sort of giving her this sort of spiritual advice, but is withholding kind of more carnal stuff until later. It's just like, that's such high level storytelling. That's so complicated and hard to make sure mm-hmm. that every single thing is so airtight and watertight. I don't know if you could just necessarily come and throw more of it against the wall. You know what I mean? Like, it does really feel like the same way a movie does, where a movie captures a moment. TV shows, I think, are allowed to make mistakes and correct those mistakes and then go into like dark periods and up periods. And, you know, that's sort of the nature of the two mediums. I think that this show could not be improved by doing more.
Could not agree with you more. This is the new example, I think, of what we should say. What can this era of television do well? It is unquestionably a TV experience. Each episode is thoughtful and curated and designed and suitable for digestion as a unit. You know, we could sit here and we could go back and we could talk about the Mexico City episode, you know, and what it meant and how it was filmed. I don't think we talked about it on the podcast, but I think you and I were texting right before you watched the episode where suddenly Scott Frank just burst into a new visual storytelling style, like almost the Soderberghian grid to express the chess matches. There was distinction between the episodes, but like a movie, exactly as you said, it was all left out there on the field and it ended with a level of not ambiguity, but certainly ellipses. There could be more, mm-hmm. but there needn't be. And that's the best feeling I think you can walk away from a work of art with. And then you add to the fact that Scott Frank wrote and directed the whole thing. So it was a, you know, a complete statement. And just to tie this conversation a little bit into the Mandalorian conversation for people who are fans of both, salute the casting. Yeah. Salute the casting. Surprising choices in a lot of ways. But particularly if you think about Alma, who was played by the director, Mariel Heller, who I believe began her career as an actor and clearly has chops, but has not been focused on that. And just her presence was so surprising, partly due to her talent, which is considerable. But I think also this is the way like a director, like a pitcher can change speeds and surprise people. I'd never seen her perform. So I didn't know her rhythms. I didn't know what we were going to get from her, which so wonderfully mirrored Beth's own experience with this woman who seems uninterested and troubled, but ultimately becomes a very warm and loving and caring figure in her life. And also casting our guy, Jojen Reed from Game of Thrones.
Thomas Brody Sangster, yeah. Yeah.
Thomas Brody Sangster. The minute you saw him in those early episodes, I was like, excuse me, what? Who is this strange boy child, man child, who kind of looks like if the youngest Seaver brother on Growing Pains had Broken Bad, like with the little goose down mustache and the knife? It was so odd,
so,
and yet totally compelling because we hadn't seen him before.
His character is also just such a great example of how when you're writing a character or when you're doing a TV show, you don't have to tell us everything. We don't really ever find out why he has the knife. He says it's for protection. Is it just bluster? Is it because of where he lives in New York? Like, what is, but it's like a flourish. And she asks him about it and he doesn't really say. The sex stuff is kind of odd. You know what I mean? Like the what his background is, or, you know, is he making money playing chess? Why isn't he as big of a deal as Beth? Like, what does he do with
explain his apartment to me. And also, since no one else is coming and going, why does she have to deflate and inflate that mattress every night? Like, let her keep it out.
I had a 20-minute conversation with my wife Phoebe about this. Like, yes. I was just like, every night she has to do a foot pump? This is crazy.
She's a guest.
Yeah. And he is essentially, him and Cleo are the two kind of windows that we have into the change that's happening in the world. Because Beth largely stays the same. She gets cooler. She buys nicer clothes. She gets into Shocking Blue and the Kinks. But for the most part, is like, I'm dedicated to chess. I'm maniacal in my obsession with this game, and I'm super into drinking too. Cleo and Benny are the world around her that's changing. And I thought that the way that he handled that was really, really cool. And I thought Sangster gives, if not a star-making performance, definitely like a holy shit, who is that performance?
Exactly. I mean, it's the best. It's just so smart. And I hope we get a chance to talk to Scott Frank again, because he's obviously a veteran who has turned himself into a major league grade A director, I think, but yeah. he just understands how you, when you have the opportunity, when Netflix gives you this kind of control, which he couldn't get in movies, but now, but as a showrunner, he can write and direct and cast and edit and be involved in every step of, in every step along the way. Every opportunity to make a decision, every obligation to make a decision is an opportunity to affect the creativity of your project.
Yeah.
And he never whiffs on them. He never shirks one. He never sort of punts one. Everything on screen is so clearly a decisive choice, from the beautiful, stunning production design to the casting.
I hope we get to talk to Scott, because I my first question would be like, you must be tired. I mean, that must have been very hard. You know, does the amount of attention to detail and the amount of, you know, clarity of artistic vision across the board to in every single element of this show is incredible.
And I would ask him, like, when you watch it, show me the cracks. Like, just tell us one that you can't watch without cringing, because I don't see anything. You know what I mean? It is just virtuosic, the way that the scenes go into each other and the visual language. And, you know, we talked about the tracking shots in and out of buildings. Like, it was just sumptuous. I think last week when we first talked about it, I was saying that, everything's blending. So I honestly, listeners, I don't remember if I said this to you or I just texted this to Chris. Same diff at this point. But we were feeling quite Marie Antoinette in our home, because there were like multiple shows that we wanted to watch together, and how fun it was. Like, we were watching one Queen's Gambit and then one Borgen. And now Queen's Gambit is gone and I feel I miss it. Like, this was the thing that was really making me feel like a night on the couch was a rich experience. No disrespect to the Staatsminister and Borgen and all that, but this felt special, and I'm glad we had a little window here to really get into it, and hopefully we'll be able to have a guest in the future to talk more about it.
You want to talk Undoing before we get to Claire?
Yeah.
I don't think you and I have a ton to add about this episode. I will note that the New Yorker writer, Patrick Radden Keefe, who wrote the amazing IRA book, Say Nothing, he was tweeting about the show last night. And he said something very interesting, which is, a friend of mine has basically figured out The Undoing and now I can't watch it.
Uh-huh. Are you his friend?
No, but I think that is in my head a little bit. I still super enjoy watching the show. Like, I think it is incredibly entertaining, and I just, having a New York show that feels and looks like New York is just really fun for me. But I was wondering whether or not you felt any of that same kind of that same feeling of like, I'm starting to see the pieces fall.
Yeah, you poisoned the well. You were right. Let's not say it again in case people don't want it. But Chris, in last week's episode of our show, identified who he thinks is the killer. There is nothing in this third episode to knock me off of that assumption. I think you nailed it. And now the show feels small for that, you know, and that's the danger of murder mysteries, right? Like, they feel endlessly expansive when they could go anywhere, when anyone's a suspect, but you have to walk that line between writing it so it makes sense that the person is the person, but also keeping it open and not committing so much so that people can still feel the fun of figuring it out for themselves, or still enter every scene in good faith, like anything could be in play here. We could be wrong, but it seems so right what you suggested last week, that it's challenging to watch it forward for any other reason. I'm also feeling, I continue to be carried along by the professionalism of the show. Like, watching Donald Sutherland and his regal, untamed eyebrows dress down NYPD detectives while staring at Renaissance art. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll take it. Similarly, you know, I think that the David E. Kelly writing and the Suzanne Beer direction are really top notch, and they keep things moving, and they really do keep things focused on the emotional free-for-all that must have been the center of the novel and must have been the reason why Nicole Kidman wanted to do the project. And I think that's really smart, because if they were to go in other directions, which they smartly don't do, the show would be in a lot worse shape. Like, I know that we like the HBO New York murder mystery, like The Night Of. I think it's probably a good thing that Hugh Grant, King of the Prison Yard, storyline is being
Hugh. Eastern Promise is Hugh. Yeah.
It's being minimized, which I think is good. There is probably a very interesting show to be made about what happens or what might happen when when one of the most privileged people on Earth goes to Rikers Island, that would have some things to say about race and class that this show has no interest in talking about whatsoever, and that's probably a good thing. Mm-hmm. If you would like to see Hugh Grant in prison in a more realistic experience, I cannot recommend Paddington 2 enough, because that he's really wonderful, especially once he is incarcerated in that film, which you have to wait till the end to see. But I can't help it. Is it nitpicky? Like nobody wants to nitpick a mystery show, but part of me is like, Hugh Grant can keep saying that she was crazy, but then like they've confiscated his phone. So there'll probably be texts, right? Like there's
I have some notes on the exact handling of this case by Detective Edgar Ramirez. More than that though, I think what's going to happen over the next maybe a couple episodes of the show, and I'm not watching ahead, is that we're going to get Broadchurched, which, if you remember the first season of Broadchurched,
yes,
a very, 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 very excellent, excellent season of television, the Olivia Colman, David Tennant first season. Basically, the genius of that show was that each week or each episode, mm-hmm. there is another really likely case to be made against a different character in each episode.
It's so suspect of the week.
Yeah, and But it's suspect of the week for the same murder. And the murder is incredibly tragic and it's tearing apart the community much in the same way that it is in The Undoing. But at the end of this episode, we're led to believe that somehow Nicole Kidman, who is our POV character, is keeping something from us. And obviously that's going to be a red herring. I mean,
was the beginning of the Donald Sutherland's Time in the Barrel episode.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's looking at the dad through the been a part of town I can't believe his town car has access to. Yeah, there's definitely going to be that, right? Like,
sure.
Because otherwise, how many more episodes of this?
I think it's six or seven, but I think it's six or seven total episodes. I'm sure Lily Rabe will get drawn into this in a way that we did not see coming.
Well, everybody, I mean, even her dad is just like, so by the way, I gave him $500,000 for school tuition.
Yes.
Very curious about the tuition of this school. Did after watching Queen's Gambit, were you like, Beth would never when Donald and Nicole were trading horsemen, so to speak.
Yeah. Like I was kind of like, wrong time to have chess in your show.
I also have to point this out. When we're talking about casting, I have nothing against the many, many talented people on this program, even in smaller parts. But is this show meant to be a vision of like Steve Bannon's globalist nightmare that like no one in society in New York is American? Because even the lawyer, Hayley Fitzgerald, this is a British stage actress,
yeah,
which is great. Like, these are all great actors. But Nicole Kidman's doing something that's a little bit down under, but, you know, skirting the edges of
I'm
the Upper
therapist.
West Side.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of that, right? You have Hugh Grant just being like, no thanks, I'm just going to be English. Like, that's just what we're going to do here. And then you've got the attorney who maybe is actually so much from New York that he starts to sound like he's not.
That guy also has been in like multiple movies where he's like an Eastern European arms scientist.
Yes.
Yeah, he's like a nuclear fission guy.
And then you have Detective Edgar Ramirez, who's just like, just trust me, I love New York Yankee baseball games. Like, okay. It's cool, but it is adding to the unreality of a show that has a, you know, I would say a complicated relationship
sure.
to reality.
Sure.
But I'm watching it.
I'm enjoying it. We can wrap it up there. We got Claire McNear coming on to talk about Jeopardy.
Did you talk to Claire? I've not yet listened to this interview. Did you share any? Do you have any personal relationship to watching Jeopardy? I've been shocked by how many people well into adult lives, their adult lives, that where we know them, suddenly you're saying, oh, I still watch it. Or,
yeah,
I
said to Claire, I think that the local news, national news, Jeopardy, you know, 60 minutes of TV, 90 minutes of scheduled time, mm-hmm. is probably like, and I'll say this, I actually didn't say this to Claire, but it was probably the most sort of stable time mm-hmm. spent with my parents over the first 20 years of my life. Was if I was eating at home, we sat down and we did watch the local news, the national news, and yep. Jeopardy together as we ate dinner. So that was like, it's such a huge part. And I compared him more to like Pat Summerall or somebody, you know, Trebek, to a voice that had just been in my life for such a long time. I love Jeopardy, but Jeopardy is also, when you watch it, you feel your blood pressure come down. You feel mm-hmm. yourself enter into a zone where it's like, ah, I can relax for a second.
Yeah, it is absolutely, I think that's the thing that is causing such an emotional reaction, because obviously people knew that Trebek was ill with a fatal disease. You know, it's shocking still to read it in print that he was 80 years old, considering he just seemed ageless and totally unstoppable. What an incredible life. Like, what a hugely successful life that he seems to have had, loved and beloved and, you know, meaning so much to so many people. But I think that it is that emotional connection, not even to the specifics of the show, but for me too. Like, when I would go visit, like, every year since my dad worked full time, my mom was a teacher. I don't know if you had this too, since your mother was also a teacher.
Yeah.
Like, there was the week after school ended the week before it began, when teachers still had to work before they get the summer off. And that week May or June and in August, September, I would be shipped off to my grandparents,
right,
who lived near each other but didn't get along very well. So I'd go from one house to the other. And I have no siblings, so the only constant is exactly what you said.
Yeah.
I was allowed to eat like Hers potato chips when I wanted, which was a good thing. And I basically just watched MTV all day. But at dinner time, the TV was changed to the news and Jeopardy. And then you keep it on for Wheel of Fortune, even though it feels a little gauche.
Sure.
And that's like it's like a national narcotic in a great way.
It's a perfect show for what it mm-hmm. is. You know, it is the perfect yeah. tone and it's the perfect execution. And, you know, I haven't really followed as avidly as like the sort of more money ball players have come in and realized how to game right. it out a little bit more. But
right.
Claire was a great interview about it. And obviously Alex Trebek will be missed. We'll be back on Thursday with more Watch. But thanks for listening, guys.
Great job, Baranski's. Great job, America.
Oh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet, toes, come on. Ugh. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
I'm so happy to be joined by The Ringer's Claire McNear, who has a new book out on Tuesday called Answers in the Form of a Question. It's her history, her historical look at Jeopardy. And obviously, kind of, that's the reason Claire's on. It's also very sad news that Alex Trebek passed away over the weekend after a battle with pancreatic cancer. And that's another reason why I wanted to talk to Claire. But Claire, ultimately, I think that we should make this sort of a more of a celebration and a joyous experience, because you did something really amazing where you have this book coming out. So congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's certainly a strange time with the news and it's a very bittersweet thing. But a lot of what I was trying to do with the book was celebrate everything that has made Jeopardy great and, you know, look towards the future. And it seemed like there was going to be some change. Obviously, that has come much sooner than I think any of us hoped. But
yeah, let's go back 3 or 4 years pre even this being an idea. Cause I think you started writing about Jeopardy more and more at the site, right? Like, cause Holzhauer and like these people who were kind of changing the way that the game was being played, and you start writing about it. But take me back to Claire McNear 5 years ago. Would she be shocked that this is what she was writing
a book about? Yeah. I mean, I certainly grew up with Jeopardy. It was a thing, you know, that I'd watch with my parents. I loved it. It was not a thing I was like a super, super diehard fan of.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, in my household, that was the only game show, which I think is true for a lot of people who watch Jeopardy. It's Jeopardy or nothing. But then when my fiance and I moved in together, we had cable, and I hadn't had cable since I was like in high school. And I had this like epiphany that, oh my God, I could DVR Jeopardy and like watch it every night and just be like a real grown up. And started doing that. And because The Ringer is a fun place to work, you get to write about what you love. And I, you know, I like to joke that it's like the perfect combination of sports and culture, where it's, you know, it's a TV show that kind of turns into a sport.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that most people have that relationship with Jeopardy, where it goes local news, national news, Jeopardy. And Trebek kind of straddled news anchor and game show host and sports announcer in some ways. I think he has like Pat Summerall-ish Joe Buck qualities in certain, like, I think people feel like they grew up with his voice, but he was never that intrusive in the actual gameplay. Can you tell me a little bit about what your impressions were of Trebek before you met him and then sort of how they changed a little bit when you were reporting the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think I, you know, as a person who grew up watching Jeopardy, he feels like such an authority figure. And yeah. And walking into my first interview with him, going into his dressing room last year, I was really nervous. I was probably as nervous as I've ever been to do an interview. And, you know, was I going to mispronounce something? Was he going to correct me? It was just going to be awful. But in fact, off camera, he just had this really sensational sense of humor. And he was really willing to kind of laugh at himself and just, you know, he was just so like affable. Like he was this wonderful kind of grandfatherly presence around the set. And you could really tell that the employees of Jeopardy just really loved working with him. And I've heard from a few over the last couple of days who are of course heartbroken.
Yeah, devastated.
But you know, yeah, he off camera, he was so much who he seemed on the show in that he was really scholarly and he was pretty serious and he did think trivia was really seriously important. But you know, he had a sense of humor. He was kind of loose and he would swear and talk about drinking. And
I love the line in your book where he says, I take my job very seriously. I don't take myself too seriously.
Yeah,
that seems to be sort of him in a nutshell.
Totally, totally. Yeah, I mean, I had asked him if he was ever embarrassed by like the rapping clues, and he said no. Like he knew people were laughing at him, and he loved it. He wanted to give that to audiences.
What kind of institutional role did he play? Because I think that there are certain shows where it's like the host is also this sort of fundamental sort of string puller in the background. And did his role change over the years? Because he obviously was doing this for so many decades. Was he more of a figurehead, or did he have a lot to do with the mechanics of the show?
Yeah. So when Jeopardy first started, when the reboot first started, I'm sorry, in 1984, it had been off the air for the better part of a decade. And he was host. He was also the executive producer of the first few seasons. And so he was really running the show. He was hiring the writers. He was dictating what happened and obviously did a lot to kind of set the tone of the show. And but then he stepped back. They eventually had an executive producer who was just an executive producer, and he was just the host. And I think to some degree, he in his later years really did view himself kind of as talent. He was the mm-hmm. host, and it was his job to do the very best version of that he could. And he worked really, really absurdly hard on it. But you know, he left the other things to other people. I think it was a big enough project that you know he was the host.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about game day at the Jeopardy set? Because that was one of the coolest parts about the book, was just sort of reading about just the sheer amount of tape they get in any one game session. And, you know, what we think is weeks of content is actually, they grind that out in like a matter of days.
Yeah. It's amazing to see. They are so good at making Jeopardy. So a typical tape day for Jeopardy, they film a full week's worth of episodes. So it's 5 episodes in a given day. And they get really good at saying tomorrow's game, yesterday's game. And, you know, of course, it was 20 minutes ago.
Sure.
But it's a long day. So the Alex Trebek would famously show up at 6 a.m. and he would have the day's games in front of him and he would review them. And he had a dictionary by his side and he was marking them up with diacritical annotations. And, you know, I think we all loved his elaborate pronunciations of foreign words. And I think that those came from him really working at it. Like, yes, yeah. He was fluent in French and was conversational in all these other languages, but he wanted to get it right. And he practiced, he studied. So he's doing that. And then, you know, this busload of terrified contestants shows up. And they've all been in a hotel and, you know, maybe they know who the champion is amongst them, but they're all so scared, so excited, because for many people on Jeopardy, it really is this lifelong dream.
Yeah.
And they just kind of get wrapped up in the whirlwind of this. There's a contestant department that basically are the only Jeopardy staffers that contestants are allowed to interact with, because there's a federal law dictating the, you know, the supremacy of the secret of trivia on television. So it really is this crazy, crazy day.
I think that the one of the myths that I had held on to entirely of my own creation was that when people were recurring champions, when they had like a run that you would remember just sort of like, oh God, this guy won again at dinner, that they were like living it up at like a Santa Monica Kimpton in like a suite. And I actually always wondered, like, well, I bet you can't really get into the mini bar because you wouldn't want to show up the next day and be carrying a hangover. But it doesn't, I mean, obviously, like a lot of these runs are taking place over the course of a day or two, right?
Yeah. I mean, even really historic. It's rare that somebody's streak has gone on for more than two tape days. It's only happened a handful of times that somebody's won more than 10 games. Ken Jennings is, other than people who kind of get the summer hiatus splitting their streak up, Ken Jennings is the only contestant who's ever lapped himself.
Wow.
And had his episode start airing while he's still competing. And of course, he had to keep it a secret, right? So he still had his job in Salt Lake City and he was going to work and, you know, he had a boss who was understanding enough. But he couldn't tell anybody why he just kept disappearing every like Tuesday and Wednesday for months and months and months.
They probably thought he was in the CIA or something.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah, he's a coder.
Andy and I have been talking about on the show a lot recently in regards to a couple of different things that have been on about like finding a lot of comfort in maybe more traditional like TV experiences that like, you know, whether it's something like Jeopardy or whether it's like a sitcom that's just like really solid, but not like exceptional, but just kind of provides almost like the nightlight TV that you sort of miss from growing up, and how, you know, challenging, like a lot of television, even the most rewarding TV right now, it can be like here, hour and 5 minutes with a lot of trauma and a lot of like, you know, really demanding visual setups or whatever. For you, is Jeopardy still comforting, or do you feel like you see all of the sort of wires and bones of the show and it's like it's kind of a little bit more work now?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly over the course of working on the book have had to take breaks from Jeopardy because it's, you know, it's like if I've been thinking about that board for 12 hours and stressing about it, I can't watch the like carefree half hour of it at 7 o'clock.
Is your Wheel of Fortune watching spiked right, then yeah, in the
exactly.
last 2 years?
I flipped. I'm Pat Sajak or nothing for me. Yeah, I mean, it really is this kind of comfort food. And I think that's also what has made the loss of Trebek so jarring for a lot of people, because not only is it something that I think a lot of people grew up on, it's a show that kids like to watch too. But he just kind of has started to feel like a member of the family. Like he's been in people's homes 5 nights a week for 37 years almost. So
yeah,
it feels very personal.
Do you think that Jeopardy is something that can exist in this streaming era? I know that, you know, Netflix has, I think, what, some producers' cuts, right?
Yeah.
Like some producers' curated collections and then a couple of championship runs. But I don't, the entire library, is that available anywhere?
No. Yeah, this is kind of a frustration of many, a Jeopardy contestant and Jeopardy fan, frankly, where what I have heard from the producers, because I asked about this, is that it's actually pretty difficult to clear the rights for everything because they so often play like a little video clip or something of, you know, the movie that's coming out, or, you know, they have some other image in there, and it's hard to then put that on a streaming service. And also because it's syndicated, you know, it's not like, oh, okay, I can, you know, at 12:01 a.m. I can log on to Netflix and watch the next day's Jeopardy episode.
Sure.
Like you're kind of subject to whatever your local affiliate's going to do. So I think it is the dream of many Jeopardy fans that there will one day be this repository. But for now, it's like this vault at the Sony studio lot.
So is it owned by the Merv Griffin production company? Like who would own the even the, do you even know who
they,
the, who would
they
own the rights?
They were bought out a while back. So I think briefly owned by Coca-Cola, actually. But Sony owns all of it now.
The way in which it's filmed and like the tone of it, I think would lend itself to, if that whole library was available and there was like a sort of randomizer button that you could just serve me up a Jeopardy from 1994, I think people would really enjoy it.
I think that's totally right. And you know, they had to stop production early last season, as a lot of shows did. And as they kind of ran out of new episodes, they dipped into that vault. And I think they literally called it a vault and started showing sort of choice episodes from Jeopardy's early years. And it really was like a sensation. It was so fun. And it was, you know, episodes that people hadn't been able to see for decades and decades, and getting to see like the old storied contestants like Frank Spangenberg, the NYPD officer with the thick mustache.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, there is just so much demand for this game, because it both has changed a lot. Like, those games look very old, very dated, but also it hasn't in certain ways, right? It's still the 61 questions and still the three contestants, and, you know, it was still Alex Trebek. It felt so familiar.
When I was watching a couple of old clips of it just before we were going to talk, I was, you know, and I was thinking about the great Jeopardy cameo that Rosie Perez makes in White Man Can't Jump, and just like the role it plays in pop culture, I realize how much of my idea of Jeopardy is also shaped by non-Jeopardy appearances of the show in pop culture. And I was wondering if you had any personal favorites among those.
I mean, it really was like a meme, especially in the 90s. It was like everybody had their Jeopardy episode. I love the ones that are just so fleeting that it's just like, oh, you know Jeopardy, you get it. And right. it randomly appears in Mr. and Mrs. Smith that like distracting like the guards outside of some like, you know, criminal's place while Angelina Jolie like assassinates him. And in one of the weirder things I had to do while reporting, I found some forum that said that that it was a notable Jeopardy game that was playing. And so I was like, I'd like to, you know, figure out what game it is. And I couldn't find like the actual video of Mr. and Mrs. Smith anywhere. And I was too lazy to like purchase a copy of it and right. get to the right place. And then I realized that it's a scene where Angelina Jolie does a striptease. And so I Googled Angelina Jolie lingerie, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And sure enough, I think it was like Pornhub.
Yes.
Had the clip ready to go. And I answered my
question.
That
should be Mr. Skin. That's like the old school, like, just so you know, in minute 94, Sharon Stone is slightly disrobed in Sliver.
It was sensational. And actually, you know what? It was not that notable episode. It was just like some random Thursday games.
You mentioned the forums. I was curious how deep the rabbit hole goes for Jeopardy fandom. Like, what are the Reddit subreddits like? Like, what are the forums of Jeopardy like? I mean, are there theories? Are there conspiracies? Like, how deep does it go?
There is a really vibrant sub community, and that was one of the things I wanted to kind of plumb in this book. I think the most amazing thing to me, as somebody who spends a fair amount of time online, is, as you do, is it's a really positive place. Like, it's a startlingly upbeat place where, you know, on the subreddit, it's entirely run by fans, and they really vigorously like police the tone of people. If you're kind of ragging on the contestant who missed the obvious clue on tonight's episode, like, they're going to delete your post and maybe ban you. Like it's amazing. And I think that there are a lot of aspiring contestants who hang out in those places and are kind of trying to learn what they can. And those are the people who get really into this kind of advanced statistics side of Jeopardy, which really is very, very rigorous.
Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't guarantee you a victory on Jeopardy either. Like, it's there's so much luck in the game that there are these people who prepare extensively and, you know, they fall in their first game.
Is there a Jeopardy version of pulling Blake Snell in the fifth inning? Like, is there a Moneyball goes too far on Jeopardy?
I mean, I think, oh man, I don't know. That's tough. I think there are a lot of conspiracies, for instance, that like James Holzhauer threw the last game of his win streak. But in fact, the people who thought that were the more casual fans and the really diehard stat people with Jeopardy were like, no, here's a mathematical theorem to explain why it's the right thing to do. And, you know, here's the list of choices he made. And so, you know, it's tough. Jeopardy is such a quick game that it's like you miss a daily double and
it's kind of over, right? Let me ask you about something other than Jeopardy, which is just, it's related to this because, you know, I know that when you're working on a project, like when I would be doing Thrones and stuff, like I would just be like, at the end of the day, I just want to do something that's not this. So you get to the end of a quote unquote work day on Jeopardy, I'm working on Answers. What is it, the thing that you turn to cleanse your palate, like over the last couple of years?
I have been watching a lot of this show called Turn, which is on Netflix. It was originally an AMC show. Yeah. Are you familiar with this show?
I am familiar with it, but I do feel like, I don't know if there are any subreddits for Turn. Like, I'm sure there are, but
I stumbled across it because the theme song is done by Matt Berninger of the National.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what is this?
And Jamie Bell is in this, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's about like spies during the American Revolutionary War, and it's based on a book, so it's rooted in real history. Uh-huh. But you know, it has been such a nice show this year in particular with the, you know, chaos of Jeopardy, chaos of the outside world, because George Washington is always right. He's always noble. The British are always nefarious. You know who's going to win the war. Like, it's great. It's so soothing. So it's like a really superb B+ show, which I find to be like a thing I crave a lot of the time now.
Yeah, that's how I feel about Undoing, which is like, yeah. I have so little expectations. I think my wife and I talk through 40% of the show. Just being like, oh, this guy definitely did it. This guy definitely did it. You know,
yep.
But are you enjoying Undoing too?
Yes, I am watching it, enjoying it for much the same reasons. It really is this, like, you know, it's not excellent, but no. Like, you know, Nicole Kidman is always kind of upset, and it's great.
She brought the mid-90s tresses back. Like,
oh,
just
yeah.
Like,
it's fantastic. Just, like, when you see the security camera footage of her at some point, it's like, oh yeah, that is her. She's dressed like a witch. Like, it's
<That's> right. I saw you in Eyes Wide Shut doing the same thing.
Exactly.
Well, Claire, I mean, I'm just so proud of you and like so excited that this is finally getting out and people can get a chance to read it. Even if it's bittersweet timing, I think it's like maybe now more than ever, people should take a step back and appreciate what an amazing pop culture accomplishment Jeopardy is, and what a great testament to that show that the book is. So thank you so much for coming on, and congratulations again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.